this information is the information you actually need relative to your market.
The hype cycle that we are in right now is the generative AI hype cycle. You will be able to have a better supply chain and decision-making capability. Therefore, you are reaching the outcome you want. Google's, Microsoft, Amazon, IBM, there is that last journey.
First, thank you for coming and listening to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, we talk about software, we talk about technology. One last thing, if you can share this podcast with anyone you know on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, on Twitter, it really helps bring people to the podcast. We don't make any money from this, so if you can do that for us, we'd really appreciate it. Now, let's move on and listen to our next guest. Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well.
This is Ayman Hussein, and right now he's Director of Customer Success, Data, AI, and Advanced Analytics, Azure Intelligence Cloud at Microsoft.
Correct.
And he's going to talk to us today about every single one of those things. So I'm looking forward to hearing it, and I hope the audience is too. So thank you for being able to join us.
Hey, it's a great pleasure.
So let's talk a little bit about your previous experience, and I think it'll give some context on sort of how you got where you are today. So if I read it right, you were at Slalom Consulting before Microsoft, and you were a senior engineer at Target, which is quite interesting, and I think everyone recognizes that name. But before that, but alongside that, you were also working as a manager at Insight. So if you could talk about any or all of those things and talk about how that has sort of colored your experience and brought you where you are today.
Absolutely. So if you think of my career journey and where it started and where it is now, one of the things I wanted to do, and this comes from a mentor and a guidance that I had from someone that was looking out for how I should grow my professional life. Bruh. And one of the things I did early in my technology career is just have contract work, staff augmentation type roles. And often, this is over a few decades, and what I did in those early days is, you know, implement solutions, technology, hardware, software, whatever you name it. And I often was struggling with the fact that these things were not designed right or properly thought out. And I was always wondering to myself, I know who comes up with these ideas, but some of these are not the right way to do it. Well, it turns out there is somebody out there doing these decision-making. Someone is coming up with the solution, the consultants, the strategist. And so I wanted to work upstream into that realm. So when I started my career, it was essential contract work, staff augmentation. And then what I did next is try to figure out where those decisions were coming from. And then a company like Insight, where it was a value-added reseller at that point and still are. And they were helping large corporations get hardware and acquire software to go do initiatives that they had on their own. So I was trying to build on top of that. So I joined Insight to see how that magic worked. I learned a lot of things from my decision-making on enterprise-level software acquisition and hardware acquisitions and implementation goals behind it. But I still found there was a gap of who's making these decisions. And so what I did after that, I joined Target. Target was at that time in one of the upcoming big box retailers, and they still are today, but at that time it was competing against Walmart in a different way. And when I thought about how they're trying to get competitive advantage, and they were using software and hardware and solutions to build the competitive advantage, their brand, their way of their doing supply chain, and their way of doing inventory management, all these things became relevant. So I was understanding how business outcomes were connected to revenue generation and how hardware and software was building on top of that. When I was still not quite there, I was still not at the top decision-making spot of what these things are being done and designed. And then I realized there's strategy consulting firms like Accenture and the Deloitte and KPMG and McKinsey is doing a lot of the design behind it. And so I said, hey, let me figure out how those organizations do it. And so I was talking to my mentor at that time, and my mentor essentially said that, look, if you want to be a part of those large dynastic consulting organization, you should have done it right after you finish your college graduation and education, because that's where they get recruited from. That's where they start their journey. I was a few years behind it, so I couldn't just jump right into it. So I had to figure out a way to find an organization that was mature enough, but yet not looking for those early college graduates to start their workforce. And Slalom Consulting was just that firm. At that time, when I joined Slalom Consulting, it was a very small firm, but doing a lot of strategy consulting and doing these businesses outcomes that customers were asking for, clients were asking for. And I had the opportunity to bring my experience of Target and Insight together to say, hey, okay, let me go to Slalom. And I had the opportunity to join them and build on top of that. And that's where I started realizing decisions were made through strategists and consultants based on business outcomes these customers and clients were asking for. And so I learned a lot about how to create the business value journey of an organization to figure out what they need for technology and hardware. And after I did that, I realized, you know, even behind the scene, there's still another journey left, which is this initiative of these product companies like Google's, the Microsoft, Amazon, IBM. There is that last journey part of it. So as I charted my career journey, I took that learning and then ended up at Microsoft. So if you think about how I evolved here, I wanted to see how things were getting done at the trench level, at the field, but you had to kind of work its way upstream to figure out what those journeys were and how they were being created. And that's where I am today. That's why I'm at Microsoft. I took the learning from Slalom, where a lot of strategy and consulting was happening. Before that, it was Insight, which is essentially a value reseller, adding a lot of those components of the decision making. And then very early on in my career, that was the contract work, staff augmentation, essentially doing other people's plans and getting, doing it right for that outcome. But ultimately, the conversation starts with the business value. No one's going to do any kind of acquisition or implementation unless it brings direct business value to their organization. And in often cases, if it's a profit organization, the bottom line, the revenue that's going to make them differentiate from their competition.
Fantastic. So let's go back a little bit to sort of your previous experience with Slalom and your previous experience with Target. And could you tell me, first of all, with Target, you talked a little bit about some of the differences they were trying to make with their technology to become competitive at that time. So could you tell me how technology enabled them to sort of enter that market space and be able to acquire market share, especially with something like Walmart? Walmart is deeply entrenched as a provider in its space. And to be able to sort of acquire market share there, you have to have quite the advantage or quite the access or both. So could you talk a little bit about what you discovered there?
Absolutely. So it is several years ago, right? So the dynamics of Target has changed since. But at that time, one of the things that they realized that, when you're a big box retailer, your cost of profit and acquisition is very thin. It's not a hugely profitable organization. So they had to keep their costs down and make it so more so that they could maximize their reward on their investment. And the way they were doing that was using technology, essentially augmenting human tasks and capability using technology, either it be the ERP, either it be the supply chain, productivity, whatever they needed to do, they were getting ahead of that. At that time, when I was working them, their e-commerce platform was not something they built. They said, hey, look, why build something when we can go get something that's available readily at that time in the industry? And so even their Target.com website was not powered by their own proprietary e-commerce solutions. They used to have this platform called Guest Services. Guest Services was the essential CRM of knowing who you're selling to, who your target customers and buyers are. They used that natively, and they created the analytics on top of that, because at that time, analytics was not a big, powerful capability natively available like we have today in .com with internet-facing solutions. And so they're building these things, and technology was the way they're differentiating at that. If you think of at that time, Walmart was a large big box retailer, and they were doing volume and they were maximizing their vendor relationships by pushing them to acquire solutions in bulk. Target decided to do a little differently. Target said, hey, look, if we're going to be in niche, we have to have unique products. And to have unique products, required to work with supply chain providers that were small. They didn't have to have dynastic capability to supply thousands of stores. They didn't enough to go in demographic and geography capability. And so they were using technology to drive that conversation to say, hey, look, if this West Coast is in the West Coast versus the East Coast, there's certain products, subtleties that'll be different. And then we'll work on maximizing those things. But they were also learning from the fact that Walmart had already negotiated large contracts with larger suppliers, you know, like the commercial good suppliers, like the toothpaste and the shampoos. And so they didn't need to have the same thing recreated from the ground up. They just maximized that value proposition by saying, hey, let's do it better, quicker, and faster, while uniquely propositioning their brand at that point. And so if you think of a company like Target, at that time, you know, and that slice of time, they were trying to do more with less and using technology and software to do just that.
So primarily optimizing their operation cost within the same sector, and that increases their margin is in sort of what they're trying to facilitate. And then doubling down on e-commerce platforms, bringing them in-house, and then optimizing them, optimizing them, of course, but at that time, there wasn't a competitor where people had their own e-commerce platforms. But a question I would have also is why didn't other people bring that in at that point? And is doing it yourself that much more cost-effective that it's able to eke out that much profit at a scale?
At that time, absolutely correct. It was much easier to do it themselves because there's not a lot of variety of solutions. Context. I'm like, we're talking about before even the internet became a mainstay in e-commerce platforms itself, right? So it was very directionally focused at that time, and that's what my experience was.
Could you talk to me a little bit about what you learned regarding leadership? And because you talked a little bit about being in at a certain point and then trying to go deeper down the pipeline and see how decisions are made and why decisions are made. So moving on to some of the other places you were at, what did you find there that was a little bit, that really was the issue with, especially with consulting, like being in different places, why things were done incorrectly or why things were done in a way that you didn't seem to feel would actually be, you know, successful in the long run?
Yeah, so this dynamic nature of consulting or solutions or implementation has rapidly changed. So think of everything that happened before COVID as just academic in nature. Those are lessons learned. Those are not applicable. And what I mean by that is what has happened in consulting and leadership all the way to now is you have to make decisions very fast. And you have to make decisions based on data. You can't do it on a gut feel. You can't do it on a gut check. You know, those leadership qualities of, hey, I'm good at this because I just feel, a spidey sense, a tingle. It's a bullcrap. And anybody's doing that kind of decision-making is really not doing decision-making. They're just going with the gut feel, right? You have to use data. Luck has, in my opinion, luck is just, right place, right time, not really a luck, you know? So if you think about the decision-making quality, it's all based on data. And if you don't have data, you're making wrong decisions, right? And so the leadership skills that I've learned is even those people that are making those strategy decisions, and if they were incorrectly made, it wasn't because somebody was just not good at their job. They made a decision based on the data they had at that time and that spot. And that decision led them to a place where it may have been incorrect and they couldn't pivot fast enough to make the change. So some of these decisions have to be made very fast, very quick. So if you think of leadership skills that are applicable today is being agile, being able to fast pivot on anything, including software engineering development, you know, the whole ability to write software for exploits or zero-day exploits that need to be corrected has to be done very fast, very quick. You can't sit in a room, have a waterfall project management approach over time and days and weeks. You have to do it very fast, very quick. So if you think of the skills required, the developers and the mindset has to pivot into a technology framework that requires you to be able to compartmentalize those things and develop against it and then deploy against it in a way that is going to maximize those decision-making points capability. If you use COVID as an example, what happened during the COVID shutdown or lockdown, supply chain took a humongous hit because the traditional way of supply chain was you looked at your demand, you ordered to your suppliers, the suppliers made the stuff, put it in a boat and shipped it across, right? That took a huge hit because everybody was trying to stay home and work from home and they were going to the grocery stores and they needed supply of products right there and then. It wasn't that everybody just woke up one morning and made the bad decisions. The organization, the world at that time was designing solutions or products on a longevity of scale that did not account for a pandemic. They did not think of it that way. They did not think supply chain would take a hit. And so when you think of all those solutions, all the platform, all the capabilities had to pivot hard was based on the fact that we need real-time data, real now. And how do you get real-time data? If you're a supply chain and a factory floor, you may have to use IoT sensors to make sure that you have data point and decision points from every segment of it. You have to have digitized capability and get rid of analog systems. You have to have that data sit in a place which is readily accessible. That's where the cloud solutions kick in, right? You have a web-based, web interface-based application, so there's not need to develop apps that have a standardized protocol and capability behind it. So web interface capability, just like you and I are talking on a digital recording platform, that's web-based. We didn't have to install fat clients on our systems and solutions to have this conversation for recording purposes. It was done because these capability of developing solutions in the traditional software engineering model was not going to scale. And so when you think of that, that's what it really identifies for good leadership and skills, is you have to make decisions based on actual data. And if you don't have the right data, you're going to make poor decisions. And you cannot wait on data all the time. You have to make sure that if data is a choke point, build systems that get the data to you fast and quick.
Got it. So let's talk about customer success and what you're doing with customer success at Microsoft. So I think we've gotten an idea of sort of the framework with which you leverage in order to gain some of the knowledge that you do have. And a lot of it is being in consulting, being able to see how lots of different organizations build, and also building yourself. And then how does that exactly help with customer success? I mean, a little bit of that is obvious, but I'd like to hear it from your point of view and see how those things have intertwined to give you the skills you need for what you do now at Microsoft.
Absolutely. So customer success, while it seems that arrived a new discipline and career trajectory, it's really not. The idea of customer success is in the words itself. You have to have a customer and you have to make sure their success is highlighted, right? In the world of Microsoft, where I live and do the customer success role, is identifying my customers, the solutions they have purchased from Microsoft, and making sure that is useful for their success. And this comes in a variety of forms and solutions. It is highlighting customer success in the world of cloud solutions, because that's where the technologies are all pivoted towards. So if you think of acquisition of tools or technologies that are SaaS oriented, I can't have a customer buy things just because it looks good. It's not a bundle pricing, it's not an enterprise agreement. They have purpose for those things that they're acquiring. I need to connect the dots. So customer success in the context of anything is about the customer's success. And some of these customers have customers of their own. So sometimes you have to go two layers deep. You have to find out their customer's success to figure out what solutions and success they would have so that they would use the technologies and solutions that you are trying to put in front of them. The discipline is around understanding the business value of every customer that you're working with. No one's buying solutions and technology or consulting or people or hiring for anything but their success. Even in the nonprofit world, if you're, let's say, a healthcare provider, your intent might be to save lives. That's their success criteria. They're not looking at how they're saving lives. They just have to make sure that they have a criteria there. So when you create metrics and dashboards and capability of return on those investments you're making, how about you connect that dotted line of, I saved lives because I buy these technologies and solutions. If you can connect that customer success journey, now you have successfully identified what it would take for you to position the advocacy of solutions and technologies that they may want or may not want. And so when you think of compete landscape, why would somebody move away from product A and go to product B? It's not because they had a good salesperson with great discipline or great pricing. Yeah, those make a difference. Ultimately, a decision may be made on price, because that's how sometimes people are going to get the better return or better investment model. But before that journey happens, there's purpose for their success. And somebody was taking the time to connect the dots. Like, hey, if you invest in my product, I can guarantee a level of success for you and your customers, because this is how you're going to get there. So that business value tie-in. So customer success roles have two purposes. One is understanding the product and portfolio and solutions that you're trying to peddle, but also understanding your customer's domain and discipline. If you're in healthcare, if you're in education, if you're in supply chain, if you're manufacturing, if you're energy, whatever it may be, you have to know those things so you can now bring purpose to the solutions and services you're trying to bring forward, including consulting. Like, even consulting organizations now have customer success, because a consulting organization will not get hired if you cannot tie the purpose of your consultation that you're going to do to that customer. So if you're a strategist and that's what you do, business value strategy, well, you have to understand that customer needs business value because maybe there's data points that show that your strategy is always off. So you need to pivot. That's how leaders get hired. That's how people are making C-suite advancements because they're saying, hey, we need this or all this kind of capability. So whenever you think of customer success in any discipline in technology, you have to understand it is by purpose of your customer or your customer success plan for that business value they need to return on those investments they're going to make sooner or later.
When we're talking about customer success, what is the range of the responsibility? So what I mean by that is when you have customer success, you're communicating to the customer that there's going to be an outcome here and based on our relationship. Is that outcome something that you manage and maintain throughout the integration process? Or you rely on a team that's external to you that maintains that? And then relative to what side of that coin you're on, how do you make sure that the outcome actually hits? Because some of these outcomes may happen, you know, a year, 2 years, and especially with a company like Microsoft, the organizations you're dealing with have long cycles for anything in general because they have 5-10 year plans. So how do you manage that and meet those expectations and you know, obviously, again, relative to how much control you have over that?
Yeah, so customer success as a discipline or a place of career has evolved and is continuing to evolve. But yes, you have to stay connected to the entire life cycle of that journey. So there are some pillars that have come into bear in the context of customer success. If you went into the internet and searched what it looked like, customer success roles, they'll tell you there are some pillars of discipline, but there is a core component. There's essential baseline, a foundational capability. One of the most important part of this is enablement and onboarding, right? No one's going to implement a tool or solution unless you got them there the proper way, and you will not get there unless you knew the outcome exit strategy. So as a customer success role, and there could be several of these in an organization due to the nature of the products and solutions are, like you mentioned, it takes years and decades to get there. You will have to stay through the journey. It's not once and done. Now, there are products and solutions that could be once and done, but those are consumer-oriented products. Perhaps there may be very solution solvent in the way that they're going to be there. I'll use an example that's becoming a recent craze, right? With the generative AI solution, a lot of people are creating AI-infused headshots for their profiles or just photographs that they want to use for headshots in their business purpose sense, right? There's a good chance that's a once and done thing, right? So the customer success role behind that paid product, many of them are free, but if you were a paid product, say if you're going to go get a digitized AI-infused headshot, you're going to buy for, say, like 20 pictures. So your customer success is about what is the outcome you want? You want good pictures, right? So I'm going to sell you that license or that you want to use case and be done with. You probably won't come back for a while unless it was that awesome, right? So the customer success journey is going to be small at that. But then the customer success journeys in large enterprise and corporations, that will take years. So you will have to know the exit strategy, the outcome will be recognized as successful. So if you think of C-suite roles, somebody says, I want to have an efficient supply chain. That board level decision or that C-suite decision is being made with the outcome that they want. Like, hey, in 5 years, I want to be profitable with my supply chain by reducing costs on whatever, right? They come up with an idea. That idea could be generated by that leader or come from a strategy consulting firm like, you know, McKinsey or somebody like that comes with that. They come up with that. So as a product provider in the world of Microsoft, what I'm doing is positioning the Azure cloud and the data analytics that go on it. I need to connect that dot that if you implement my data and AI strategy, my intelligent cloud strategy, my Azure platforms, you will be able to have a better supply chain and decision-making capability. Therefore, you are reaching the outcome you want. So that customer success manager role or customer success role will have to make sure that you have that exit strategy in mind. And it could take years to get there. So you have to understand that those investments that are being made are focused on that. So yes, the journey can take years. It can be taking months. It could take minutes. It depends on what kind of product and solution you're highlighting and positioning.
So you alluded to and continued on the theme of AI, and which is sort of the main purpose of this meeting and podcast and episode. So I'd love you to expand on on that a little bit. So just to give you a framework, we've talked about how important getting an understanding of what's going on is essential for decision making. Instinctual decision making essentially has been left in the dust as more and more information has entered the market and more opportunity to get understanding customer behaviors into the market. So pivots are happening faster and faster. So one question from that is how is there's analytics, but there's also how is AI helping with that? And then as AI continues to evolve and it seems to almost exponentially accelerate, and also exponentially accelerate to the degree to which it can be integrated with it in a way as its interface with reality is the surface area of that is getting higher and higher. With all these sort of graphs going in that direction, how are customer success people, and specifically you, dealing with that? How are customer expectations changing? How are they sort of affecting the way that you're dealing with them? And then a big part of this is how do you find out more deeper and deeper what these different sectors need? It is quite tough to do that very quickly. So how are you managing all that in your role?
So from the perspective of AI and solutions that are built on what we call artificial intelligence, you know, it's not new. It's been around for a while. What is becoming more relevant is the use case capability for what that solution space was doing. So the hype cycle that we are in right now is the generative AI hype cycle, right? And it's not hype cycle. It is solutions capability on it, large language models, right? So when you think of the use case, it is a cycle, but it's not new. These large language models have been around for a while in different capabilities. So when you're thinking of how AI is influencing these decision-making, it's augmenting humanity, the idea of a person doing more of what they need to do with decision points and solutions that have augmented them to be faster at that decision-making point. So those AI models are nothing but trained models of human activities and construct. And that's the way you want to start looking at it. So anything that in any discipline, any industry doesn't have any tie-in of any kind. If you are a medical professional, a doctor, and you want to make some caregiving decisions, you can do it one of two ways. You can go to school for decades and become a professional expert because you have acquired the knowledge and put it in your brain. So you can look at these different capabilities and say, oh, this is what's wrong with you. This is the ailment. Here's a pharmaceutical medicine that will fix it. Or you can leverage the data points that are actually digitally available. All those academic textbooks of medical journals are available in the internet in some fashion. If they're not, they're getting digitized very fast right now. And then you have a large language model that is trained against that set of data. So now you can use the same capability of decision-making by prompting an encyclopedia of data that has been categorized using efficient data storage systems and databases and connective data points and indexes that AI is saying, hey, you're asking the same thing a human would be asked if you were trying to do medical science or some kind of healthcare caregiving. I'm just doing it faster. And the way I'm doing it faster is using a large language model that's trained to understand your prompt, that's trained on a lot of GPU chipsets that are going to return the value of what you're asking in a very efficient, fast, quick manner. And so the augmentation there is of a human purpose and discipline. So you're not magically creating jobs and roles of people that did not exist. Like if you are using AI to replace decision-making and solutions, you're essentially replacing a human that previously was training that model. So that you can't just artificially create a genre or existence because it has to be trained. Now, yeah, so there's a lot of people that are worried that it's going to take their job away, like coders and software developers are very concerned that using ChatGPT type capability can augment software development. Absolutely. So the reason we had so many software developers because you needed that human brain to create software in large amounts because you couldn't do that. Now, yes, ChatGPT now may be able to train, give you the code base, be able to translate code and do it faster. What did you do? You just replaced humans with the technology and skills required to do that because you have a baseline trained index or capability that's going into the decision-making process. So anything AI is not new. AI is just a faster capability to make those decisions on the data. If you have bad data, you'll make bad decisions. So guess what you have to do in the world of AI? If you want to make good decisions, make sure your data points are there in the way those language model training capabilities done or capability to make those things get done, right? A software developer, let's say, wants to move from C# to Java coding, right? And they say, oh, I'm going to use ChatGPT to train myself to code, do that. Very good. Awesome. But if you did not have code samples of C# or Java to be trained against, that software developer is never going to learn the skill of how to convert code. So that codex or that engine that's behind these, a lot of popular software developer platforms that says that you can translate code, you can ask ChatGPT like questions to it. Well, it's pointless if you didn't have the baseline data point to train it against it. So you still have to collect the data, and that data acquisition will not happen automatically. It can be digitized. So think of sensor data, IoT devices, collecting all the data points and storing it in a data system is likely going to be in the cloud because that's where the volume and scale capability is available, but you still have to train against it. And so these language models have to be trained over and over again. That's why Chat 3.5 and ChatGPT 4 and ChatGPT 5, they're using, you know, tokens and multiple billions of parameters capability because you are getting more data and you have to train it faster and quicker. And the way you train faster and quicker is having silicon-based GPU chips available in large quantities so you can run these multi-processing capabilities to train that. So ultimately, it is data-driven. And the domain that it comes for is going to be based on the domain that the data has translated to. Think of law, right? You see those pictures of lawyers and their law firm portraits sitting in front of a bank of books that look like encyclopedias on the shelf behind them. Well, those are cases that have been documented and printed and published. And so when they have a case law conversation, they're looking through all the historical information. There's a librarian in a law firm that knows all the cases and all the different states and jurisdictions those have been done. Well, if you digitize all that, that same lawyer can create a brief by asking the right question to that repository of data and get it done. But what if those case law was not digitized? Well, then you still have to hit the books. You still have to flip the page and look through it word by word. And so if you think of acquisition of a data point, you have to have enough data in the system, in the world, in the internet to be able to confidently make the right decisions, or you will continue to have bad decision makings no matter how amazing that AI solution is.
So when we talk about this, you made a point to talk about the different ways AI can augment people's experiences. But then the integration part is where there's a lot of complexity because there are, first of all, pre-existing systems or pre-existing understanding of what kind of interface that they're going to have to be able to be functional. And with AI, the interface is I'm going to say fundamentally different, but it is the resolution is not as high. It doesn't have to be. And that's an advantage of AI, at least for now, especially specifically with language models. The resolution is human language. There's also accuracy and security. And you know, because the resolution is not as high and because it's almost a stats model, you're not exactly sure what will come out, for better or for worse. Still an advantage, but you're not exactly sure, which brings in security concerns. So there's those two parts. Those parts aren't new, but that they are unique. And then obviously once you scale all this, it becomes a lot more complicated. Now, is it still extremely valuable to bring in? Absolutely. It's almost inevitable that you must. So, you know, whether you have to sell it or not is one thing, but being able to actually have a successful integration with an existing organization, it's a complex task. So how do you go about getting that even started? Justifying the cost is definitely one thing, and for some people it may not be as valuable, but how do you even approach that? Like, how do you even say, okay, look, and this is even before you start talking about, hey, if you don't have a whole data infrastructure that can feed this model information that you're comfortable is objectively valuable. That this is after you've made the assumption that this is the actual, this information is the information you actually need relative to your market, and can also, that is wide enough that and when your market shifts, you're still getting that information, right? As you've talked about, rotations in markets are happening at a faster and faster rate. So when we think about this architecture that you've sort of drawn out over the last few minutes, how are you able to ensure and feel, make a customer feel like they will have some success, like with all of this?
Yeah, so it's a great question. AI is not going to help you do anything unless you do not understand what is the choke point. I will use enterprise commercial software as an example, but let's say you have a CRM system. I don't even have to talk about a brand. It can be any brand. A CRM system. The purpose of CRM is, you know, customer data for whatever it is, either you resell, retail, whatever, energy distribution. You have a database of customer information. And you are a salesperson. Today, what you have to do is open up your CRM, look at the customer profile, their address, their location, their buying habits. All of those data points are in their system. And what that person is doing is using their sales prowess or sales experience of the decades of experience that they have amassed to say, hey, maybe this person will like to buy this, or maybe this person is ripe for, maybe a car dealership is a great example. If you have a good CRM in a car dealership, you may know exactly when this person may want to buy another car, or what kind of model they want, and what did they buy previously, and what did they have good success with, and how did they achieve success with that car they picked up. So you have this database environment where these informations, the CRM, is stored and capability addressed. Now let's put AI on top of that. Now you say, okay, what would AI bring to me in this space? Well, what AI will do for you is make that decision make faster, right? You're using machine learning and AI models to give you those prompts. So you can say, hey, look at my CRM and tell me who's ready to buy a car. You're using English language to prompt your CRM to give you an answer. Well, you can use indexes, you can use search parameters, you can write SQL queries to do exactly just that same thing. Well, if you were to do it today in the traditional model, you need somebody that knows SQL for maybe the database environment you're using. So maybe that's a technologist. So I need a query to do table joins and this and this and this, because the data point I want is how many people are going to buy a car and when they're ready to buy the car. So you have a lot of tasks and capabilities to get there. But the purpose of that intent and the exercise is that I want to find out who's going to buy more cars and when they're going to buy it. And I have a lot of decision-making points. Oh, by the way, I need it now. I need it fast and really quick. That's where an AI comes into place, because you're not able to bolt on AI solutions. So before you bolt on AI solutions, that CRM platform might be ready for AI plug-in. So if that CRM platform maker did not create an AI plug-in capable solution, then you are going to be at a disadvantage. Your AI solution will need intermediary place to go before you make the decision. So you'll take all the data out of the CRM, put it in a data lake of some sort, that bolt-on AI on top of that to build the intelligence for you to have that prompt-like conversation to say who's going to buy a car, when, and how. So if you're a software developer and you're a software manufacturer, you're making software and platforms, you need to have that AI plugin bolt-in capable design ready now, or work towards creating a way to do that tomorrow. Microsoft, I use example of that. We use Bing as our search engine for internet. That now has ChatGPT capability built on top of it. Well, what is that? It's the software developers that writes the search engine for Bing and have developed over years and decades realize that for them to implement the ChatGPT AI bolt-on on top of that would need X number of parameters and X number of software development. So they start working on it. And the reason they got faster and quicker at it is because over the decade of software development, they went into an agile mindset. They went into this Scrum mindset where they make small changes faster and quicker. So the software engineering group had to, over years, and pivot away from waterfall approaches into an agile approach to develop software. So when AI became a fad and it became a real necessity, the software developers sat in a room during a decision-making conversation and said, hey, we need to bolt on top of this. What are the different APIs we need to think about? How do we secure it and govern it? How do we make sure it's the right amount of data? How we create the packages of the intelligence to go crunch it against the CPU? They created that framework very relatively quick and then implemented it because they're software developers and they're using agile framework. But you still needed to bolt on AI on top of that to make that capability. So CRM or internet search engines, or let's say a healthcare provider trying to figure out healthcare patient data, will need that interface built in some fashion. So if you're commercializing AI for the purpose of it, the first thing you need to do is, how do I bring AI to the decision-making that I'm making today? So is it human-based? Is it machine-based? Is it data point-based? All of those things still requires you to design the product and solution so that you can bolt on AI on top of that. So the journey of, am I going to make the right investment here, is based on, do you need to make decisions fast and quick? Weather models is a great example. Weather data is where AI really got its refinement and edge, like Weather Channel or any of those people that are making weather decisions, because weather is a volatile creature. If you don't make the right prediction, you could have damages and outcomes to crops and, you know, health and life. People might die if you couldn't predict a tornado or a hurricane coming down someplace, right? So if you think of that, I need to make the decision model very fast and very quick. So how am I going to get that? Well, all the data captured by satellites and weather stations across the world and the globe and zip codes have to be aggregated in a place where these models can be crunched and the models have to change. If you ever look at the Weather Channel or any weather really news, you'll notice when they're predicting a hurricane path, they have different models. They have the European model, they have the American model, they have the German model, because all these different models are using data points to say, hey, my model says this weather path of that hurricane is going to be. That's why they show the squiggly lines on those maps, because they can't really predict where it's going to happen, because the data has to change fast and quick to show you what that journey looks like for that hurricane during that period of a weather event. So when you think of that, you're creating an interface for those weather meteorologist people to be able to take the data, put it in, and get the response fast and quick. Same thing with healthcare, same thing with inventory management, same thing with energy and oil and gas. You have to have a decision-making point that is accelerated because of the data you already have and data you're acquiring. And if you don't bring them together in your software engineering platform, you won't succeed. Let me use an example of what happens in digital photography. The context of digital photography is no different than traditional photography. You still have to have a camera with a lens that takes a picture that's going to be converted into pixels or a chemical-based photographic grain, and then you look at the image. But what has happened over time is digital cameras became very popular. They became better. Digital software became popular and became better. So the traditional camera-based and chemical-based photography has fallen on the wayside. But guess what? The photographer is still applicable, because you still need to know what you're looking at. You have to still frame the picture. You still need to know colors. You still need to know how to correct imperfections in pictures or remove digitally. But you're just using digital technology to do that. If the color red doesn't look color red, that picture is no good, because, you know, your perception is still a human-based element. What you've just made the digital photographer become is faster, quicker at digitizing those images and editing those images faster and quicker. And that's what AI is doing. So AI is now saying, hey, this color of the sky doesn't look right. Maybe it should be a little bit more blue or a little bit less gray. That is trained on the fact that a photographer, a human, actually says, this is what a blue sky looks like, this is what a gray sky looks like, this is what a red sky looks like, and they trained it. So now that AI intelligence behind Adobe or whatever that photograph digitized experience is using that model to say that. So if you can't create the model, which is really coming from humans, that digital photographic experience will not look right. And that's why you have these this context of hallucinations. When an AI model doesn't know what they're doing, they just create makeup stuff, right? And sometimes they're cool, sometimes they're just off the wall. So that decision making is exactly how you would want to get there. And so if you're writing software, developing code, developing something that requires you to inject AI or machine learning into it, make sure that you write software and code with the capability of that. And by the way, in the world of economics and commercialization, you have to make sure that the data is private, so privacy matters. It's secure, so security matters. So you have to now inject the same principles that you would have done in traditional software development to now become more relevant in that space and creating those points of design to be applicable faster. So if you are a software engineer working for a software company that is making money based on their software, you want AI, ML, machine learning, governance, security, all to be a part of your big picture, because if you're not ready for it, you may miss out on the ability to move, pivot fast, quick, and then the competitive advantage is lost.
If the outcome is reached, but the customer is not happy with its value proposition, it could be because it's simply didn't give the result that the customer expected, or the customer's customers didn't find it as useful as your original customer would have hoped. So I guess my real question is, like, where have you seen that the most mismatched, or what kind of either person or organization?
It happens all the time. So what happens is, that's the product feedback loop, right? You wanted an outcome. We agreed on the outcome. I provided you the outcome, but you as a customer's customer did not get that. So you'll come back to me and it's like, oh, by the way, you know what? If it could do this, that would be more valuable. So now I'm going to take that to my product engineers and develop the product feature for it, right? If that's important. Or I can just say, well, you know, too bad, don't buy it again. Like, it's the same thing happens when you go to a restaurant. If you see a picture of a nice meal and you order it and it doesn't satisfy you in the same way, you're not going to buy it. Yeah, you're not going to buy it again, right? You're not going to buy it again. But guess what? It may not be the problem of the restaurant. It might be the problem of the menu item, right? Like, there's restaurants that you always go, like you go to, you know, Cheesecake Factory, Olive Garden, whatever. You go to those places all the time, but not all the dishes on the menu are good, right? So you might just say, like, hey, you know what? If you go to Cheesecake Factory, don't buy this because that sucks. But still go to Cheesecake Factory because they have 10 other things that you like. So the same thing applies to products, right? You will have a customer that says, I thought it was going to achieve this, but it didn't. So you have two points to do. You can take that decision point back to your product engineers. Maybe it's a product deficiency. It's like, oh, it'd be nice had it this feature. So let me go talk to developers and product engineers to see if they can create the additional feature. Because if I did that, that customer now would be satisfied because it achieved the success they wanted, even though they knew it wasn't going to do that. They just, oh, look, I didn't get the reward I wanted, but if you had this part, it would have been nicer. And so that decision-making of buying again will come back from that. Now, it could also be that you don't want this. This is not what you want. You just decided and you abandoned the product. And what will happen is, if it's a competitive landscape, the person that has that feature and product capability will now win the day.
So one of the things I'm thinking is, if it happens a lot, then a lot of customer success is how to pivot when it does happen. Is that fair to say?
It is happening a lot. It happens all the time. Why do you think there are so many solutions and products out there? Because the people that are not pivoting, they're not happening, are losing out. Think of Microsoft itself. There's a time when Microsoft products are the best, and then there are times when they're like, oh, this is the worst of the product, but then you go back up to it again. It's a cyclical journey. Large companies always have cyclical journeys. There's time when IBM was on top, IBM was not. NVIDIA is on top, NVIDIA is not. AMD is on top, AMD is not. All these things have a cycle, and it's customer success oriented. Ultimately, at that last bit, that's why every company is investing in customer success roles, because if you don't get that product feedback loop established faster, you may lose that journey at that point.
Right. So how do you deal with that? Because it seems like customer success is pivotal in an organization's understanding of where it needs to go in the future. Hence the sort of focus on agile systems when it comes to sort of building things and getting an understanding of that. But how do you see that? Like, how do you see that reality, and how do you preserve that relationship? Because there's different points, right? You could build a whole new product, or you can talk to the customer and say, here's where you might need to have put it, right? With the outcome still being reached. But, you know, this thing, at the end of the day, these are tools, right? It is how you use them. And now that you have, now that you are in a way at step one of your understanding of the tool, you have reached an outcome, and now you have the information necessary to make the decision for step two, right? Our tool can still do that. The tool is the tool. What kind of conversations are you having at that point?
It depends on the discipline and the industry. Not every conversation has to happen. And what I mean by that is, your outcome is based on the outcome at that point. Like, you don't wake up, software companies don't create answers for all the software a customer needs. That's why we have variety in the mix, right? There's ERP software, there's CRM software, there's productivity software. There's not a one software that does it all. Now, there are companies that are achieving or trying to achieve that, but they're still not there yet. Microsoft being one of those companies, right? We want to do it all. But we won't be able to do it all. We can't do it all because we have to create this product and also understand the reward of the product in the journey of that conversation. We won't have it all, right? We don't need it because we won't make money on it all. And so when you have a customer in that same boat, the product feedback loop is important so that you can create the next version and iteration of it. And if the customer and you have a good relationship and they believe that you can achieve that, that's where the buying relation really stays. Like, if I say, look, you know, Chris, I don't think this is going to do what you want, but give me 6 months. I'll create a product feedback loop and our product engineers will drop a feature in 6 months. And if you believe that I can do that because I have a track record of doing that, you will stay and you'll persevere and you'll say, you know what, I'm not going to change a decision just because one feature is missing. I'll wait till that product comes back. That's why you have product roadmaps. Almost all companies have product roadmaps. That's where you talk about what's going to come in 6 months, a year, a journey, because you are buying that visibility. It's like, yes, this company can pull this off. Even if the product doesn't exist, I'm going to go to them. I'll tell them the feedback. We got to do user testing. We're going to beta release. We're going to do all that. And then we're going to provide the feedback. They'll go correct those things. And then they will have the version two of it or the pre-release version that will fix that. That's the relationship of a customer success manager. Understanding that, getting that feedback to the right place, and also being honest about it. I might take it back to product engineering. Product engineering will be like, nope, we're never going to do that. It's not going to happen. Not our core focus. Got to go tell the customer. So I'll go back to the customer and say, hey, we can't do that, but I have a way to integrate a third-party product to do that. That's why we have Bolt-On. That's why we have a third-party products ecosystem across the world. Like the people are saying, we don't have that, but if you added this and I'm going to have an API that works together, I'm going to have a support structure that works together. I'm going to have a way to make sure that the Lego pieces work and connect together without having a detrimental impact. If we do that conversation, that's what customer success is. Customer success, make sure your outcome is aligned, what the gaps are, finding a solution for that. If there's a gap that is not addressable, being clear about it so the customer knows that they'll not get that outcome they want at the last journey point of it. You're not having a fabrication. Now, the misses of customer success is usually when there's a hype cycle or a marketing cycle that actually makes that messaging very challenging. Like, oh, marketing says we can do that. And then customer success manager sitting there, it's like, no, it doesn't. So who are you going to go blame? Are you going to go blame marketing or product for committing or the salesperson for saying something that's not going to be done? Well, if you have a good relationship, you can go to the customer and say, hey, by the way, you bought this, but let me tell you, you can only get A and B. You won't get C. If the customer flips out, that's a different problem. But the customer says, yeah, I kind of figured A and B and C won't be there. You ever document it. You go and focus on the outcome. You achieve A and B, and then you say C is a gap, but guess what? I'm going to take the C, go back to product engineering, and have them start working on it. So now we can also do C sooner than later.
Got it. Eamon, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, yeah. This has been great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.